Fire her with a smooch? I stand over her with my knife. Ms. Keene's voice fades to a mosquito whine. My throat closes off. It is hard to breathe. I put out my hand to steady myself against the table. David pins her froggy hands to the dissection tray. He spreads her froggy legs and pins her froggy feet. I have to slice open her belly. She doesn't say a word. She is already dead. A scream starts in my gut. I can feel the cut, smell the dirt, leaves in my hair. I don't remember passing out. David says I hit my head on the edge of the table on my way down. The nurse calls my mom because I need stitches. The doctor stares into the back of my eyes with a bright light. Can she read the thoughts hidden there? If she can, what will she do? Call the cops? Send me to the nut house? Do I want her to? I just want to sleep. The whole point of not talking about it, of silencing the memory, is to make it go away. It won't. I'll need brain surgery to cut it out of my head. Maybe I should wait until David Petrakis is a doctor. Let him do it. Model Citizen. Heather has landed a modeling job at a department store in the mall. She says she was buying socks with her mother the week after her braces came off, and some lady asked if she modeled. I suspect the fact that her dad works for the mall management company had something to do with it. The modeling gig is paying off in major Martha points. They all want to be Heather's new best friend. But she asked me to go with her for the bathing suit shoot. I think she's afraid to screw up in front of them. Heather's mother drives us. She asks if I want to be a model. Heather says I am too shy. I look at her mother's eyes, watching me in the rearview mirror, and hide my mouth with my fingers. The scabs on my lips are especially gross in that little rectangle mirror. Of course I want to be a model. I want to paint my eyelids gold. I saw that on a magazine cover, and it looked amazing. Turn the model into a sexy alien that everyone would look at, but nobody dared to touch. I like cheeseburgers too much to be a model. Heather has stopped eating and complains about fluid retention. She should worry more about brain retention the way she's dieting away her gray matter. At last check, she was wearing a size 1.5, and she just has to get down to a size 1. The photo shoot is in a building cold enough to store ice. Heather looks like our Thanksgiving turkey wearing a blue bikini. Her goosebumps are bigger than her boobs. I'm shivering, and I'm wearing my ski jacket and a wool sweater. The photographer turns up the radio and starts bossing the girls around. Heather totally gets into it. She throws her head back, stares at the camera, flashes her teeth. The photographer keeps saying, "Sexy, sexy, very cute, look this way, sexy, think beach, think boys." It creeps me out. Heather sneezes in the middle of a group pose and her mother runs in with tissues. It must be catching. My throat is killing me. I want a nap. I don't buy the gold eyeshadow, but I do pick up a bottle of Black Death nail polish. It's gloomy, with squiggly lines of red in it. My nails are bitten to the bleeding point, so it will look natural. I need to get a shirt that matches. Something in a tubercular gray. Death by Algebra. Mr. Stettman won't give up. He is determined to prove once and for all that algebra is something we will use the rest of our lives. If he succeeds, I think they should give him the Teacher of the Century Award and a 2-week vacation in Hawaii, all expenses paid. He comes to class each day with a new real-life application. It is sweet that he cares enough about algebra and his students to want to bring them together. He's like a grandfather who wants to fix up 2 young kids that he just knows would make a great couple. Only the kids have nothing in common and they hate each other. Today's application has something to do with buying guppies at the pet store and calculating how many guppies you could breed if you wanted to go into the guppy business. Once the guppies turned into X's and Y's, my contacts fog. Class ends in a debate between the animal rights activists, who say it is immoral to own fish, and the red-blooded capitalists, who know lots of better ways to make money than investing in fish that eat their young. I watch the snow falling outside. Word work. Hairwoman is torturing us with essays. Do English teachers spend their vacations dreaming up these things? The first essay this semester was a dud. Why America is Great in 500 words. She gave us 3 weeks. Only Tiffany Wilson turned it in on time. But the assignment was not a complete failure. Hairwoman runs the drama club, and she recruited several new members based on their performances as to why they needed an extension. She has a warped sense of humor as well as a demented beautician. The next essay was supposed to be fictional. The best lost homework excuse ever in 500 words. We had one night. No one was late. But now Hairwoman is on a roll. How I would change high school. Lower the driving age to 14. The perfect job. Her topics are fun, but she keeps cranking them out one after the next. First, she broke our spirits by overwhelming us with work we couldn't really complain about because the topics are the kind of things we talk about all the time. Recently, she started sneaking grammar, shudder, into the classroom. One day we worked on verb tenses. I surfed the net. I surfed the net. I was surfing the net. Then, lively adjectives. Does it sound better to say, Nicole's old lacrosse stick hit me on the head? Or, Nicole's barf-yellow, gnarled, blood-stained lacrosse stick hit me on the head? She even tried to teach us the difference between active voice, I snarfed the Oreos, and passive voice, the Oreos got snarfed. Words are hard work. I hope they send Hairwoman to a conference or something. I'm ready to help pay for a sub. Naming the Monster. I work on Heather's posters for 2 weeks. I try to draw them in the art room, but too many people watch me. It is quiet in my closet, and the markers smell good. I could stay here forever. Bring a can, save a life. Heather told me to be direct. It is the only way to get what we want. I draw posters of basketball players shooting cans through a hoop. They demonstrate very good form. Heather has another modeling job. Tennis clothes, I think. She asked me to hang the posters for her. I actually don't mind. It's nice having kids see me doing something good. Might help my reputation. I'm hanging a poster outside the metal shop room when it creeps up. Little flecks of metal slice through my veins. It whispers to me. Fresh meat. That's what it whispers. It found me again. I thought I could ignore it. There are 400 other freshmen in here, 200 female, plus all the other grades, but he whispers to me. I can smell him over the noise of the metal shop, and I drop my poster and the masking tape, and I want to throw up, and I can smell him, and I run, and he remembers, and he knows. He whispers in my ear. I lie to Heather about the masking tape and say I put it back in the supply box. Rent Round 3. My guidance counselor calls Mom at the store to pave the way for my report card. Must remember to send her a thank you note. By the time we eat dinner, the battle is roaring at full pitch. Grades, blah, 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 attitude, blah, 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 help around the house, blah, 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 not a kid anymore, blah, blah, blah. I watch the eruptions. Mount Dad, long dormant, now considered armed and dangerous. Mount St. Mom, oozing lava, spitting flame, warn the villagers to run into the sea. Behind my eyes, I conjugate irregular Spanish verbs. A minor blizzard blows outside. The weather lady says it's a lake effect storm. The wind from Canada sucks up water from Lake Ontario, runs it through the freeze machine, and dumps it on Syracuse. I can feel the wind fighting to break through our storm windows. I want the snow to bury our house. They keep asking questions like, "What is wrong with you?" and "Do you think this is cute?" How can I answer? I don't have to. They don't want to hear anything I have to say. They ground me until the second coming. I have to come straight home after school unless Mom arranges for me to meet with a teacher. I can't go to Heather's. They are going to disconnect the cable. Don't think they'll follow through on that one. I do my homework and show it to them like a good little girl. When they send me to bed, I write a runaway note and leave it on my desk. Mom finds me sleeping in my bedroom closet. She hands me a pillow and closes the door again. No more blah blahs. I open up a paperclip and scratch it across the inside of my left wrist. Pitiful. If a suicide attempt is a cry for help, then what is this? A whimper? A peep? I draw little window cracks of blood, etching line after line until it stops hurting. It looks like I arm wrestled a rose bush. Mom sees the wrist at breakfast. Mom. I don't have time for this, Melinda. Me. Silence. She says suicide is for cowards. This is an ugly, nasty mom side. She bought a book about it. Tough Love, Sour Sugar, Barbed Velvet, Silent Talk. She leaves the book on the back of the toilet to educate me. She's figured out that I don't say too much. It bugs her. Can it? Lunch with Heather starts cold. Since winter break, she's been sitting at the fringe of the Martha table, and I eat on the other side of her. I can tell something is up as soon as I walk in. All the Marthas are wearing matching outfits. Navy corduroy miniskirts, striped tops, and clear plastic purses. They must have gone shopping together. Heather doesn't match. They hadn't invited her. She is too cool to be nervous about this. I am nervous for her. I take an enormous bite of my PBJ and try not to choke. They wait until she has a mouthful of cottage cheese. Siobhan puts a can of beets on the table. Siobhan. What's this? Heather, swallowing. It's a can of beets? Siobhan. No duh, but we found an entire bag of beets in the collection closet. They must have come from you. Heather. A neighbor gave them to me. They're beets. People eat them. What's the problem? The rest of the Marthas sigh on cue. Apparently, beets are not good enough. Real Marthas only collect food that they like to eat, like cranberry sauce, dolphin safe tuna, or baby peas. I can see Heather dig her nails into her palms under the table. The peanut butter molds to the roof of my mouth like a retainer. Siobhan. That's not all. Your numbers are abysmal. Heather. What numbers? Siobhan. Your can quota. You aren't carrying your weight. You aren't contributing. Heather. We've only been doing this for a week. I know I'll get more. Emily. It's not just the can quota. Your posters are ridiculous. My little brother could have done a better job. It's no wonder no one wants to help us. You've turned this project into a joke. Emily slides her tray across to Heather. Heather gets up without a word and clears it away. Traitor. She isn't going to stick up for my posters. The peanut butter in my mouth hardens. Siobhan pokes Emily and looks at the door. Siobhan. It's him. Andy Evans just walked in. I think he's looking for you, Em. I turn around. They are talking about it. Andy. Andy Evans. Short, stabby name. Andy Evans, who strolls in carrying a takeout bag from Taco Bell. He offers the cafeteria monitor a burrito. Emily and Siobhan giggle. Heather returns, her smile back in place, and asks if Andy is as bad as everyone says. Emily blushes the color of canned beets. Siobhan. It's just a rumor. Emily. Fact, he's gorgeous. Fact, he's rich. Fact, he's just the itsiest bit dangerous, and he called me last night. Siobhan. Rumor, he sleeps with anything. The peanut butter locks my jaws closed. Emily. I don't believe it. Rumors are spread by jealous people. Hi, Andy. Did you bring enough lunch for everyone? It feels like the Prince of Darkness has swept his cloak over the table. The lights dim. I shiver. Andy stands behind me to flirt with Emily. I lean into the table to stay as far away from him as I can. The table saws me in half. Emily's mouth moves, the fluorescent lights glittering on her teeth. The other girls scooch toward Emily to soak up her attractiveness rays. Andy must be talking, too. I can feel deep vibrations in my backbone, like a thudding speaker. I can't hear the words. He twirls my ponytail in his fingers. Emily's eyes narrow. I mumble something idiotic and run for the bathroom. I heave lunch into the toilet, then wash my face with some ice water that comes out of the hot faucet. Heather does not come looking for me. Dark art. The cement slab sky hangs inches above our heads. Which direction is east? It has been so long since I've seen the sun, I can't remember. Turtlenecks creep out of bottom drawers. Turtle faces pull back into winter clothes. We won't see some kids until spring. Mr. Freeman is in trouble. Big time. He gave up paperwork when the school board X'd out his supply budget. They have caught up with him. Teachers just handed in the second marking period grades, and Mr. Freeman gave out 210 A's. Someone smelled a rat. Probably the office secretary. I wonder if they called him down to Principal's office and put this on his permanent record. He has stopped working on his canvas. The painting we all thought was going to be this awesome, earth-shattering piece of art that would be auctioned for $1 million. The art room is cold, Mr. Freeman's face a shade of gray-purple. If he wasn't so depressed, I'd ask him what the name of that color is. He just sits on his stool, a blue, broken cricket husk. No one talks to him. We blow on our fingers to warm them up, and sculpt or draw or paint or sketch, or, in my case, carve. I start a new linoleum block. My last tree looked like it had died from some fungal infection. Not the effect I wanted at all. The cold makes the linoleum stiffer than usual. I dig the chisel into the block and push, trying to follow the line of a tree trunk. I follow the line of my thumb instead and gash myself. I swear and stick my thumb in my mouth. Everybody looks at me, so I take it out again. Mr. Freeman hurries over with a box of Kleenex. It isn't a deep cut, and I shake my head when he asks if I want to go to the nurse's office. He washes my chisel off in the sink and puts bleach on it, some sort of AIDS regulation. When it is germ-free and dry, he carries it back toward my table, but stops in front of his canvas. He hasn't finished painting. The bottom right corner is empty. The prisoners' faces are menacing. You can't take your eyes off them. I wouldn't want a painting like that hanging over my couch. It looks like it might come alive at night. Mr. Freeman steps back, as if he has just seen something new to his own picture. He slices the canvas with my chisel, ruining it with a long, ripping sound that makes the entire class gasp. My report card. Attitude, D. Lunch, C. Clothes, C minus. Social studies, D. Biology, B. English, C minus. Spanish, C minus. Algebra, C minus. Gym, C minus. Art, A. Third marking period. Death of the wombat. The wombat is dead. No assembly, no vote. Principal made an announcement this morning. He said hornets better represent the Meriwether spirit than foreign marsupials. Plus, the wombat mascot costume was going to suck money from the prom committee's budget. We're the hornets, and that is final. The seniors support this decision totally. They wouldn't be able to hold their head up if the prom had been moved from the Holiday Inn ballroom to the gym. That would be so elementary school. Our cheerleaders are working on annoying chants that end in lots of buzzing. I think this is a mistake. I have visions of opposing teams making enormous fly swatters and giant cans of insecticide out of paper mache to humiliate us during halftime programs. I'm allergic to hornets. One sting and my skin bubbles with hives and my throat closes up. Cold weather and buses. I missed the bus because I couldn't believe how dark it was when my alarm clock went off. I need a clock that will turn on a 300-watt bulb when it's time to get up. Either that or a rooster. When I realize how late it is, I decide not to rush. Why bother? Mom comes downstairs and I'm reading the funnies and eating oatmeal. Mom, you missed the bus again. I nod. Mom, you expect me to drive you again? Another nod. Mom, you'll need boots. It's a long walk and it snowed again last night. I'm already late. That is unexpected, but not harsh. The walk isn't that bad. It's not like she made me hike 10 miles through a snowstorm uphill in both directions or anything. The streets are quiet and pretty. The snow covers yesterday's slush and settles on the rooftops like powdered sugar on a gingerbread town. By the time I get to Fayette's, the town bakery, I'm hungry again. Fayette's makes wicked good jelly donuts, and I have lunch money in my pocket. I decide to buy 2 donuts and call it brunch. I cross the parking lot, and it comes out the door. Andy Evans with a raspberry-dripping jelly donut in one hand and a cup of coffee in the other. I stop on a frozen puddle. Maybe he won't notice me if I stand still. That's how rabbits survive. They freeze in the presence of predators. He sets the coffee on top of his car and fumbles in his pocket for the keys. Very, very adult, this coffee, car keys, cut school guy. He drops the keys and swears. He isn't going to notice me. I'm not here. He can't see me standing here in my purple marshmallow jacket. But, of course, my luck with this guy sucks. So he turns his head and sees me. And Wolf smiles, showing, oh, granny, what big teeth you have. He steps toward me, holding out the donut. Want a bite? He asks. Bunny Rabbit bolts, leaving fast tracks in the snow. Get away, get away, get away. Why didn't I run like this before when I was a one-piece talking girl? Running makes me feel like I'm 11 years old and fast. I burn a strip up the sidewalk, melting snow and ice 3 feet on either side. When I stop, a brand new thought explodes in my head. Why go to school? Escape. The first hour of blowing off school is great. No one to tell me what to do, what to read, what to say. It's like living in an MTV video, not with the stupid costumes, but wearing that butt-strutting, I-do-what-I-want attitude. I wander down Main Street. Beauty parlor, 7-Eleven, bank, card store. The rotating bank sign says it is 22 degrees. I wander up the other side. Appliance store, hardware store, parking lot, grocery store. My insides are cold from breathing in frozen air. I can feel the hairs in my nose crackle. My strut slows to a foot-dragging schlump. I even think about trudging uphill to school. At least it's heated. I bet kids in Arizona enjoy playing hooky more than kids trapped in central New York. No slush, no yellow snow. I'm saved by a Centro bus. It coughs and rumbles and spits out 2 old women in front of the grocery store. I climb on. Destination? The mall. You never think about the mall being closed. It's always supposed to be there, like milk in the refrigerator, or God. But it is just opening when I get off the bus. Store managers juggle key rings and extra large coffees. Then the cage gates fly up in the air. Lights wink on, the fountains jump, music plays behind the giant ferns, and the mall is open. White-haired grandmas and grandpops power walk squeak, squeak, going so fast they don't even look at the window displays. I hunt spring fashions. Nothing that fit last year fits now. How can I shop with Mom if I don't want to talk to her? She might love it, no arguing that way. But then I'd have to wear the clothes she picked out. Conundrum, a 3-point vocab word. I sit by the central elevator where they set up Santa's workshop after Halloween. The air smells like French fries and floor cleaner. The sun through the skylight is summer hot and I shed layers. Jacket, hat, mittens, sweater. I lose 7 pounds in half a minute. Feel like I could float up alongside the elevator. Tiny brown birds sing above me. No one knows how they got in, but they live in the mall and sing pretty. I lie on the bench and watch the birds weave through the warm air until the sun burns so bright, I'm afraid it will make holes in my eyeballs. I should probably tell someone. Just tell someone. Get it over with. Let it out. Blurt it out. I want to be in fifth grade again. Now that is a deep, dark secret, almost as big as the other one. Fifth grade was easy. Old enough to play outside without Mom, too young to go off the block. The perfect leash length. A rent-a-cop strolls by. He studies the wax women in the Sears window, then strolls back the other way. He doesn't even bother with a fake smile or an, "Are you lost?" I'm not in fifth grade. He starts back for a third pass, his finger on his radio. Will he turn me in? Time to find that bus stop. I spend the rest of the day waiting for it to be 2:48, so it's not all that different from school. I figure I learned a good lesson, and I set my alarm clock early for the next day. I wake up on time for 4 days in a row, get on the bus 4 days in a row, ride home after school. I want to scream. I think I'll need to take a day off every once in a while. Code breaking. Hair woman has been buying new earrings. One pair hangs all the way down to her shoulders. Another has bells in them like the pair Heather gave me at Christmas. I guess I can't wear mine anymore. There should be a law. It's Nathaniel Hawthorne month in English. Poor Nathaniel. Does he know what they've done to him? We are reading The Scarlet Letter one sentence at a time, tearing it up and chewing on its bones. It's all about symbolism, says Hair Woman. Every word chosen by Nathaniel, every comma, every paragraph break, these were all done on purpose. To get a decent grade in her class, we have to figure out what he was really trying to say. Why couldn't he just say what he meant? Would they pin scarlet letters on his chest? B for blunt, S for straightforward. I can't whine too much. Some of it is fun. It's like a code, breaking into his head and finding the key to his secrets. Like the whole guilt thing. Of course you know the minister feels guilty, and Hester feels guilty, but Nathaniel wants us to know this is a big deal. If he kept repeating, "She felt guilty, she felt guilty, she felt guilty," it would be a boring book and no one would buy it. So he planted symbols, like the weather, and the whole light-dark thing to show us how poor Hester feels. I wonder if Hester tried to say no. She's kind of quiet. We would get along. I can see us, living in the woods, her wearing that A, me with an S maybe. S for silent, for stupid, for scared. S for silly, for shame. So the code-breaking part was fun for the first lesson, but a little of it goes a long way. Hair Woman is hammering it to death. Hair Woman. The description of the house with bits of glass embedded in the walls. What does it mean? Utter silence from the class. A fly left over from fall buzzes against the cold window. A locker slams in the hall. Hair Woman answers her own question. Think of what it would look like. A wall with glass embedded in it. It would reflect? Sparkle? Shine on sunny days, maybe. Come on, people, I shouldn't have to do this by myself. Glass in the wall. We use that on top of prison walls nowadays. Hawthorne is showing us that the house is a prison, or a dangerous place, maybe. It is hurtful. Now, I asked you to find some examples of the use of color. Who can list a few pages where color is described? The fly buzzes a farewell buzz and dies. Rachel Rochelle, my ex-best friend. Who cares what the color means? How do you know what he meant to say? I mean, did he leave another book called Symbolism in My Books? If he didn't, then you could just be making all of this up. Does anyone really think this guy sat down and stuck all kinds of hidden meanings into his story? It's just a story. Hair Woman. This is Hawthorne. One of the greatest American novelists. He didn't do anything by accident. He was a genius. Rachel Rochelle. I thought we were supposed to have opinions here. My opinion is that it's kind of hard to read. But the part about how Hester gets in trouble and the preacher guy almost gets away with it, well, that's a good story. But I think you are making all this symbolism stuff up. I don't believe any of it. Hair woman.
Do you tell your math teacher you don't believe that 3 times 4 equals 12? Well, Hawthorne's symbolism is just like multiplication. Once you figure it out, it's as clear as day.
The bell rings. Hair woman blocks the door to give out our assignment. A 500-word essay on symbolism, how to find hidden meanings in Hawthorne. The whole class yells at Rachel Rochelle in the hall. That's what you get for speaking up. Stunted. Mr. Freeman has found a way around the authorities again. He painted the names of all his students on one wall of the classroom, then made a column for each week left of school. Each week, he evaluates our progress and makes a note on the wall. He calls it a necessary compromise. Next to my name, he's painted a question mark. My tree is frozen. A kindergartner could carve a better tree. I've stopped counting the linoleum blocks I've ruined. Mr. Freeman has reserved the rest of them for me. Good thing, too. I am dying to try a different subject. Something easy like designing an entire city or copying the Mona Lisa. But he won't budge. He suggested I try a different medium, so I used purple finger paints. The paint cooled my hands, but it did nothing for my tree. Trees. On a shelf, I find a book of landscapes filled with illustrations of every stinking tree that grows. Sycamore, linden, aspen, willow, fir, tulip poplar, chestnut, elm, spruce, pine. Their bark, flowers, limbs, needles, nuts. I feel like a regular forester, but I can't do what I'm supposed to. The last time Mr. Freeman had anything good to say to me was when I made that stupid turkey bone thing. Mr. Freeman is having his own problems. He mostly sits on his stool and stares at a new canvas. It is painted one color, so blue it's almost black. No light comes out of it or goes in. No shadows without light. Ivy asks him what it is. Mr. Freeman snaps out of his funk and looks at her like he just realized the room was full of students. Mr. Freeman.
It is Venice at night. The color of an accountant's soul. A love rejected. I grew mold on an orange this color when I lived in Boston. It's the blood of imbeciles. Confusion. Tenure. The inside of a lock, the taste of iron. Despair. A city with the streetlights shot out. Smoker's lung. The hair of a small girl who grows up hopeless. The heart of a school board director.
He is warming up for a full-fledged rant when the bell rings. Some teachers rumor whisper he's having a breakdown. I think he's the sanest person I know. Lunch doom. Nothing good ever happens at lunch. The cafeteria is a giant soundstage where they film daily segments of teenage humiliation rituals. And it smells gross. I sit with Heather as usual, but we are off by ourselves in a corner by the courtyard, not near the Marthas. Heather sits so her back is to the rest of the cafeteria. She can watch the wind shift the drifts of snow trapped in the courtyard behind me. I can feel the wind seep through the glass and penetrate my shirt. I am not listening too closely as Heather ahems her way to what is on her mind. The noise of 400 mouths moving, consuming, pulls me away from her. The background pulsing of the dishwashers, the squeal of announcements that no one hears, it is a vespiary, the Hornet Haven. I am a small ant crouched by the entrance, with the winter wind at my back. I smother my green beans with mashed potatoes. Heather nibbles through her jicama and whole grain roll, and blows me off while she eats her baby carrots. Heather. This is really awkward. I mean, how do you say something like this? No matter what. No, I don't want to say that. I mean, we kind of paired up at the beginning of the year when I was new and didn't know anyone, and that was really, really sweet of you, but I think it's time for us both to admit that we just are very different. She studies her no-fat yogurt. I try to think of something bitchy, something wicked and cruel. I can't. Me.
You mean we're not friends anymore?
Heather, smiling with her mouth but not her eyes. We were never really, really friends, were we? I mean, it's not like I ever slept over at your house or anything. We like to do different things. I have my modeling and I like to shop. Me. I like to shop. Heather. You don't like anything. You are the most depressed person I've ever met, and excuse me for saying this, but you are no fun to be around, and I think you need professional help. Up until this very instant, I had never seriously thought of Heather as my one true friend in the world. But now I am desperate to be her pal, her buddy, to giggle with her, to gossip with her. I want her to paint my toenails. Me. I was the only person who talked to you on the first day of school, and now you're blowing me off because I'm a little depressed? Isn't that what friends are for? To help each other out in bad times? Heather. I knew you would take this the wrong way. You are just so weird sometimes. I squint at the wall of hearts on the other side of the room. Lovers can spend $5 to get a red or pink heart with their initials on it mounted on the wall for Valentine's Day. It looks so out of place. Those red splotches on blue. The jocks, excuse me, the student athletes, sit in front of the hearts to judge the new romances. Poor Heather. There are no Hallmark cards for breaking up with friends. I know what she's thinking. She has a choice. She can hang out with me and get a reputation of being a creepy weirdo who might show up with a gun someday. Or she can be a Martha. One of the girls who get good grades, do nice things, and ski well. Which would I choose? Heather. When you get through this life sucks phase, I'm sure lots of people will want to be your friend, but you just can't cut classes or not show up to school. What's next? Hanging out with the dopers? Me. Is this the part where you try to be nice to me? Heather. You have a reputation. Me. For what? Heather, look, you can't eat lunch with me anymore. I'm sorry. Oh, and don't eat those potato chips. They'll make you break out. She neatly wraps her trash into a wax paper ball and deposits it in the garbage can. Then she walks to the Martha table. Her friends scooch down to make room for her. They swallow her whole, and she never looks back at me. Not once. Conjugate this. I cut class. You cut class. He, she, it cuts class. We cut class. They cut class. We all cut class. I cannot say this in Spanish because I did not go to Spanish today. Gracias a Dios. Hasta luego. Cutting out hearts. When we get off the bus on Valentine's Day, a girl with white blonde hair bursts into tears. I love you, Angela, spelled with a J instead of a G, is spray-painted into the snowbank along the parking lot. I don't know if Angela is crying because she is happy or because her heart's desire can't spell. Her honey is waiting with a red rose. They kiss right there in front of everybody. Happy Valentine's Day. It's caught me by surprise. Valentine's Day was a big, hairy deal in elementary school because you had to give cards to everyone in your class. Even the kid who made you step in dog poop. Then the class mom brought in pink frosted cupcakes, and we traded those little candy hearts that said, Hot Baby, and Be Mine. The holiday went underground in middle school. No parties. No shoeboxes with red cutout hearts for your drugstore Valentines. To tell someone you liked them, you had to use layers and layers of friends, as in, Janet told me to tell you that Stephen told me that Dougie said Karen was talking to April and she hinted that Sarah's brother Mark has a friend named Tony who might like you. What are you going to do? It is easier to floss with barbed wire than admit you like someone in middle school. I go with the flow toward my locker. We are all dressed in down jackets and vests, so we collide and roll like bumper cars at the state fair. I notice envelopes taped to some lockers, but don't really think about it until I find one on mine. It says, Melinda. It has to be a joke. Someone put it there to make me look stupid. I peer over my left shoulder, then my right, for groups of evil kids pointing at me. All I see are the backs of heads. What if it is real? What if it's from a boy? My heart stops, then stutters and pumps again. No, not Andy. His style is definitely not romantic.
Maybe David Petrak is my lab partner. He watches me when he thinks I can't see him, afraid I'm going to break the lab equipment or faint again. Sometimes he smiles at me, an anxious smile, the kind you use on a dog that might bite. All I have to do is open the envelope. I can't stand it. I walk past my locker and go straight to biology. Ms. Keene decided it would be cute to review birds and bees in honor of Valentine's Day. Nothing practical, of course. No information about why hormones can make you crazy, or why your face only breaks out at the worst time, or how to tell if somebody really gave you a Valentine's card on your locker. No, she really teaches us about the birds and the bees. Notes of love and betrayal are passed hand over hand, as if the lab tables were lanes on Cupid's highway. Ms. Keene draws a picture of an egg with a baby chick inside it. David Petrakis is fighting to stay awake. Does he like me? I make him nervous. He thinks I'm going to ruin his grade. But maybe I'm growing on him. Do I want him to like me? I chew my thumbnail. No, I just want anyone to like me. I want a note with a heart on it. I pull the edge of my thumbnail back too far and it bleeds. I squeeze my thumb so the blood gathers in a perfect sphere before it collapses and slides toward the palm of my hand. David hands me a tissue. I press it into the cut. The white cells of paper dissolve as the red floods them. It doesn't hurt. Nothing hurts except the small smiles and blushes that flash across the room like tiny sparrows. I open my notebook and write a note to David. Thanks. I slide the notebook over to him. He swallows hard, his Adam's apple bouncing to the bottom of his neck and back up again. He writes back, "You are welcome." Now what? I squeeze the tissue harder on my thumb to concentrate. Ms. Keene's baby bird hatches on the board. I draw a picture of Ms. Keene as a robin. David smiles. He draws a branch under her feet and slides the notebook back to me. I try to connect the branch to a tree. It looks pretty good, better than anything I have drawn so far in art. The bell rings, and David's hand brushes against mine as he picks up his books. I bolt from my seat. I'm afraid to look at him. What if he thinks I already opened his card and I hate his guts, which is why I didn't say anything? But I can't say anything because the card could be a joke, or from some other silent watcher who blends in with the blur of lockers and doors. My locker. The card is still there, a white patch of hope with my name on it. I tear it off and open it. Something falls to my feet. The card has a picture of two cutesy teddy bears sharing a pot of honey. I open it. Thanks for understanding. You're the sweetest. It is signed with a purple pen. Good luck, Heather. I bend down to find what dropped from the card. It was the friendship necklace I had given Heather in a fit of insanity around Christmas. Stupid, stupid, stupid. How stupid could I be? I hear a cracking inside me. My ribs are collapsing in on my lungs, which is why I can't breathe. I stumble down the hall, down another hall, down another hall, till I find my very own door and slip inside and throw the lock, not even bothering to turn on the lights, just falling. Falling a mile downhill to the bottom of my brown chair, where I can sink my teeth into the soft white skin of my wrist and cry like the baby I am. I rock, thumping my head against the cinder block wall. A half-forgotten holiday has unveiled every knife that sticks inside me, every cut. No Rachel, no Heather, not even a silly, geeky boy who would like the inside girl I think I am. Our Lady of the Waiting Room. I find Lady of Mercy Hospital by accident. I fall asleep on the bus and miss the mall completely. The hospital's worth a try. Maybe I can learn some pre-med stuff for David. In a sick kind of way, I love it. There are waiting rooms on almost every floor. I don't want to attract too much attention to myself, so I stay on the move, checking my watch constantly, trying to look as if I have a reason for being here. I'm afraid I'll get caught, but the people around me have other things to worry about. The hospital is the perfect place to be invisible, and the cafeteria food is better than the schools. The worst waiting room is on the heart attack floor.
It is crowded with gray-faced women twisting their wedding rings and watching the doors for a familiar doctor. One lady just sobs. She doesn't care that total strangers watch her nose drip or that people can hear her as soon as they get off the elevator. Her cries stop just short of screaming. They make me shiver. I snag a couple of copies of People magazine and I am out of there. The maternity ward is dangerous because people there are happy. They ask me questions. Who am I waiting for? When is the baby due? Is it my mother? A sister? If I wanted people to ask me questions, I would have gone to school. I say I have to call my father and flee. The cafeteria is cool. Huge. Full of people wearing doctor-nurse clothes with college degree posture and beepers. I always thought hospital people would be real health nuts, but these guys eat junk food like it's going out of style. Big piles of nachos, cheeseburgers as wide as plates, cherry pie, potato chips, all the good stuff. One lone cafeteria worker named Lola stands by the steamed fish and onion tray. I feel bad for her, so I buy the fish platter. I also buy a plate of mashed potatoes and gravy and a yogurt. I find a seat next to a table of serious, frowning, silver-haired men who use words so long I'm surprised they don't choke. Very official. Nice to hang around people who sound like they know what they're doing. After lunch, I wander up to the fifth floor to an adult surgery wing where waiting family members concentrate on the television. I sit where I can watch the nurse's station and, beyond that, a couple of hospital rooms. It looks like a good place to get sick. The doctors and nurses seem smart, but they smile every once in a while. A laundry room worker pushes an enormous basket of green hospital gowns, the kind that shows your butt if you don't hold it closed, to a storage area. I follow him. If anyone asks, I'm looking for a water fountain. No one asks. I pick up a gown. I want to put it on and crawl under the white knobbly blanket and white sheets in one of those high-off-the-ground beds and sleep. It is getting harder to sleep at home. How long would it take for the nurses to figure out I don't belong here? Would they let me rest for a few days? A stretcher pushed by a tall guy with muscles sweeps down the hall. One woman walks beside it, a nurse. I have no idea what is wrong with the patient, but his eyes are closed and a thin line of blood seeps through a bandage on his neck. I put the gown back. There is nothing wrong with me. These are really sick people, sick that you can see. I head for the elevator. The bus is on its way. Clash of the Titans. We have a meeting with Principal. Someone has noticed that I've been absent. And that I don't talk. They figure I'm more a head case than a criminal, so they call in the guidance counselor, too. Mother's mouth twitches with words she doesn't want to say in front of strangers. Dad keeps checking his beeper, hoping someone will call. I sip water from a paper cup. If the cup were lead crystal, I would open my mouth and take a bite. Crunch, crunch, swallow. They want me to speak. Why won't you say anything? For the love of God, open your mouth. This is childish, Melinda. Say something. You're only hurting yourself by refusing to cooperate. I don't know why she's doing this to us. The principal ha-hums loudly and gets in the middle. Principal. We all agree we are here to help. Let's start with these grades. They are not what we expected from you, Melissa. Dad. Melinda. Principal. Melinda! Last year you were a straight B student, no behavioral problem, few absences, but the reports I've been getting, well, what can we say? Mother. That's the point. She won't say anything. I can't get a word out of her. She's mute. Guidance counselor. I think we need to explore the family dynamics at play here. Mother. She's jerking us around to get attention. Me, inside my head. Would you listen? Would you believe me? Fat chance. Dad. Well, something is wrong. What have you done to her? I had a sweet, loving little girl last year, but as soon as she comes up here, she clams up, skips school, and flushes her grades down the toilet. I golf with the school board president, you know. Mother. We don't care who you know, Jack. We have to get Melinda to talk. Guidance counselor. leaning forward, looking at Mom and Dad.
Do the two of you have marriage issues?
Mother responds with unladylike language. Father suggests that the guidance counselor visit that hot, scary underground world. The guidance counselor grows quiet. Maybe she understands why I keep it zipped. Principal sits back in his chair and doodles a hornet. Tick, tick, tick. I'm missing study hall for this. Nap time. How many days until graduation? I lost track. Have to find a calendar. Mother and father apologize. They sing a show tune.
What are we to do? What are we to do? She's so blue, we're just two. What, oh, what are we supposed to do?
In my head world, they jump on Principal's desk and perform a tap dance routine. A spotlight flashes on them. A chorus line joins in, and the guidance counselor dances around a spangled cane. I giggle. Zap, back in their world. Mother,
you think this is funny? We are talking about your future. Your life, Melinda.
Father, I don't know where you picked up that slacker attitude, but you certainly didn't learn it at home, probably from the bad influences up here. Guidance counselor.
Actually, Melinda has some very nice friends. I've seen her helping that group of girls who volunteer so much. Meg Harcutt, Emily Briggs, Siobhan Fallon.
Principal stops doodling.
Very nice girls. They all come from good families.
He looks at me for the first time and tilts his head to one side.
Those are your friends?
Do they choose to be so dense? Were they born that way? I have no friends. I have nothing. I say nothing. I am nothing. I wonder how long it takes to ride a bus to Arizona. Miss. Meriwether in school suspension. This is my consequence. It is in my contract. It's true what they tell you about not signing anything without reading it carefully. Even better, pay a lawyer to read it carefully. The guidance counselor dreamed up the contract after our cozy get-together in the principal's office. It lists a million things I'm not supposed to do and the consequences I'll suffer if I do them. The consequences for minor offenses, like being late to class or not participating, were stupid. They wanted me to write an essay. So I took another day off school, and bingo, I earned a trip to Miss. It's a classroom painted white with uncomfortable chairs and a lamp that buzzes like an angry hive. The inmates of Miss are commanded to sit and stare at the empty walls. It is supposed to bore us into submission or prepare us for the insane asylum. Our guard dog today is Mr. Neck. He curls his lip and growls at me. I think this is part of his punishment for that bigoted crap he pulled in class. There are two other convicts with me. One has a cross tattooed on his shaved skull. He sits like a granite boy waiting for a chisel so he can carve himself out of the mountainside. The other kid looks completely normal. His clothes are a little freaky, maybe. But that's a misdemeanor here, not a felony. When Mr. Neck gets up to greet a late arrival, the normal-looking kid tells me he likes to start fires. Our last companion is Andy Evans. My breakfast turns to hydrochloric acid. He grins at Mr. Neck and sits down next to me. Mr. Neck.
Cutting again, Andy?
Andy Beast.
No, sir. One of your colleagues thinks I have an authority problem. Can you believe it?
Mr. Neck.
No more talking.
I am Bunny Rabbit again, hiding in the open. I sit like I have an egg in my mouth. One move, one word, and the egg will shatter and blow up the world. I am getting seriously weird in the head. When Mr. Neck isn't looking, Andy blows in my ear. I want to kill him. Picasso. I can't do anything, not even an art class. Mr. Freeman, a pro at staring out the window himself, thinks he knows what's wrong.
Your imagination is paralyzed, he declares. You need to take a trip.
Ears perk up all over the classroom and someone turns down the radio. A trip? Is he planning a field trip?
You need to visit the mind of a great one, continues Mr. Freeman.
Papers flutter as the class sighs. The radio sings louder again. He pushes my pitiful linoleum block aside and gently sets down an enormous book. Picasso. He whispers like a priest. Picasso, who saw the truth, who painted the truth, molded it, ripped from the earth with two angry hands. He pauses. But I'm getting carried away. I nod. See Picasso, he commands. I can't do everything for you. You must walk alone to find your soul. Blah, blah, yeah. Looking at pictures would be better than watching snowdrift. I open the book. Picasso sure had a thing for naked women. Why not draw them with their clothes on? Who sits around without a shirt on plucking a mandolin? Why not draw naked guys, just to be fair? Naked women is art. Naked guys a no-no, I bet. Probably because most painters are men. I don't like the first chapters. Besides all the naked women, he painted these blue pictures, like he ran out of red and green for a few weeks. He painted circus people and some dancers who look like they are standing in smog. He should have made them cough. The next chapter steals my breath away. It takes me out of the room. It confuses me while one little part of my brain jumps up and down screaming, I get it! I get it! Cubism. Seeing beyond what is on the surface. Moving both eyes and a nose to the side of the face. Dicing bodies and tables and guitars as if they were celery sticks and rearranging them so that you have to really see them to see them. Amazing. What did the world look like to him? I wish he had gone to high school at Merriweather. I bet we could have hung out. I search the whole book and never see one picture of a tree. Maybe Picasso couldn't do trees either. Why did I get stuck with such a lame idea? I sketch a cubist tree with hundreds of skinny rectangles for branches. They look like lockers, boxes, glass shards, lips with triangle brown leaves. I drop the sketch on Mr. Freeman's desk. Now you're getting somewhere, he says. He gives me a thumbs up. Riding shotgun. I am a good girl. I go to every single class for a week. It feels good to know what the teachers are talking about again. My parents get the news flash from the guidance counselor. They aren't sure how to react. Happy because I'm behaving, or angrier still that they have to be happy about such a minor thing as a kid who goes to class every day. The guidance counselor convinces them I need a reward, a chew toy or something. They settle on new clothes. I'm outgrowing everything I own. But shopping with my mother? Just shoot me and put me out of my misery. Anything but a shopping trip with Mom. She hates shopping with me. At the mall, she stalks ahead, chin high, eyelids twitching because I won't try on the practical, stylish clothes she likes. Mother is the rock. I am the ocean. I have to pout and roll my eyes for hours until she finally wears down and crumbles into 1,000 grains of beach sand. It takes a lot of energy. I don't think I have it in me. Apparently, Mom isn't up to the drag and wine mall gig either. When they announce I've earned new clothes, they add that I have to get them at Efforts, so Mom can use her discount. I'm supposed to take the bus after school and meet her at the store. In a way, I'm glad. Get in, buy, get out, like ripping off a Band-Aid. It seems like a good idea until I'm standing at the bus stop in front of school as a blizzard rips through the county. The wind chill must be 20 below and I don't have a hat or mittens. I try keeping my back to the wind, but my rear end freezes. Facing it is impossible. The snow blows up under my eyelids and fills my ears. That's why I don't hear the car pull up next to me. When the horn blows, I nearly jump out of my skin. It's Mr. Freeman. Need a ride? Mr. Freeman's car shocks me. It's a blue Volvo, a safe Swedish box. I had him figured for an old VW bus. It is clean. I had visions of art supplies, posters, and rotting fruit everywhere. When I get in, classical music plays quietly. Well, wonders never cease. He says dropping me off in the city is only a little out of his way. He'd love to meet my mother. My eyes widen in fear. Maybe not, he says.
I brush the melting snow from my head and hold my hands in front of the heating vent. He turns the fan up full blast. As I thaw, I count the mileage markers on the side of the road, keeping an eye out for interesting roadkill. We get a lot of dead deer in the suburbs. Sometimes poor people take the venison for their winter's meat, but most of the time the carcasses rot until their skin hangs like ribbons over their bones. We head west to the big city.